Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of Building It Up with Bertelsmann, India's first podcast that features and focuses on the growth pangs of Indian startups. I'm your host, Ankur Variku, and today is a fascinating individual who is completely into online education and killing it. Ashwin Damera. He's the co-founder and director of Eruditus, which has a very interesting business model. Eruditus today works with global business schools such as MIT, Columbia, INSEAD, Wharton, and Tuck in bringing high-quality executive education programs to individuals and organizations based in India, Middle East, and Asia. Ashwin is not new to the entrepreneurial world. In 2010, he and Chaitanya started Eruditus, but prior to that, Ashwin was running Travel Guru, which was backed by Sequoia Capital. He grew the company to 350 employees by 2009 and sold it to Travelocity. But today, Eruditus is an interesting piece. It started with what I would call a largely offline setup, bringing high-quality, top-grade global education into India in a classroom-based format. But today, it has completely been taken over by the online education space. They have a global clientele of students from across Middle East, now Latin America, Southeast Asia, and its plan is to enroll over 30,000 students over different courses and clock a 300% growth from last year. On this episode, Ashwin and I spoke a lot of things, from what does it mean to go global, what are the problems that online education face and how did Eruditus solve that, and how does he, as a founder based in India, manage different time zones and what all does it comprise. Please join me in this episode and I hope you have as much fun as I did in talking to Ashwin. Thank you so much for joining the episode, Ashwin. It's a pleasure to have you on Building It Up with Bertelsmann.
Thanks, Ankur, and I'm excited to be here as well.
So, what I find most interesting is you have managed to create a global giant out of online education, which is a pretty hard industry to crack into. And you've essentially gone and closed one of the best known brands in the world, whether it's the Harvards or the MITs or so on and so forth. And you've told them that, hey, you are doing whatever you're doing in the geographies that you are in, which is the US or Europe, but there's this massive opportunity that's outside of the geographies and I can help you there. Which is a fascinating take, honestly. But let me start with something more basic. How did the idea of foraying into online education even come about? Because you've been an entrepreneur in a completely different vertical of travel. And how did online education come into your radar?
So back in 2010, when we started, my co-founder Chaitanya and myself, we were beneficiaries of very high quality business education. And one of the thoughts that we were pondering over was how could we make that more affordable and scalable for a vast majority of people who really can't pack their bags and get to the US or Europe, right? And we said, okay, how about getting the university to the student versus the dominant model of the student going to the university? And that really was the idea. Chaitanya had actually worked at INSEAD, is also an INSEAD MBA, and so INSEAD became our first partner school. And then Wharton, because they had a partnership with INSEAD and other schools. We started off as an India business. We were both based in Mumbai. We still are, though we travel a lot. And the brands were very powerful. We were very successful in the early days. What we realized was access also meant affordability, but went beyond affordability. And a lot of people, even at a low price, will not be able to access high quality education if it's not delivered in a context or in a framework that makes sense to them. And then, you know, it's actually going over the questions for today, I realized that this journey hasn't been that difficult. But as you look back, clearly there were pivotal moments. About 2013, we said, let's open up in Dubai. In 2015, we started our Singapore office, and this year we started Boston and Mexico City. And the realization was that this problem statement, right, making high-quality education accessible and affordable applies in India, it applies in Mexico City, it applies in China. By the way, it also applies in the U.S. Because the elite universities are not always accessible or affordable. And so the global growth of ours was really driven by the same mission. We didn't reinvent the mission just for the sake of going global. We realized that the opportunity is broader. And I would say that linking this back to education, in education, it's tough to build a global brand. But when you have MIT or a Harvard or a Columbia or a Berkeley that you work with, you don't need to. You need to leverage that. Right? And so we were somewhat lucky given our partnership model. Today, 90% of our students come from outside of India. So it's pretty much a global business, but I would say 90% of our people sit within India. And so it's a global business, but, you know, it's being run out of India. And that actually makes us very proud to see that journey.
What is the core business model, Ashwin? Like when you go to a university such as a MIT or a Harvard or a Sloan, what is the proposition? What is it that you tell them and what is it that you offer to them?
What we tell them is fairly simple. What we tell them is that in their current model, which is basically delivering high quality education on campus, they are reaching maybe a third of the global audience that they could otherwise reach. And by the way, remember, these institutions are also mission-driven, right? And so they are interested in global. All of them understand that the world is global today. It was global many years ago. And so what we tell them is that we can be a partner to make that global foray easy for them. They're not interested in having, you know, 100 people sitting in different parts of the world. You know, they're universities. Their core is academic strength, intellectual capital, and research, right? Yeah. And so we're saying you play to your strength. We will help you with the enrollment, the tech stack, the marketing, all of that in these different geographies. And the partnership, therefore, I think is a win-win for both of us. Initially, the pitch was about doing classroom programs in India, and then it became Dubai and Singapore. Increasingly, our focus is just online. And in fact, 90% of our enrollments is also in our online courses. And I think one of the key skills we bring to these universities in the online space is also being able to take the classroom programs and translate that into an online medium. So building the tech and product stack to make that work so that we still have a 90% completion rate, we have a net promoter score that's upwards of 50, all of these matter to these academic institutions. So the pitch really is, listen, there are a bunch of non-consumers who want your content. And by the way, these are leaders who are doing great things in their home geographies, but they can't access it in the way it's packaged today. Yeah. Can we work together to make that happen, right? And it's an easy pitch for most schools to understand.
I'm curious to know, Ashwin, when these schools work with you, do they create content specifically for these geographies on the online medium? Or is it that they just do whatever they're doing on campus and they're going about their normal job and you do the hard work of picking up that content, converting it into an online experience for students who are outside of the campus?
So in most of our online courses, let's say there's a, you know, batch of 500 students enrolled, they will come from 50 plus countries. And so there's no one country that's represented where you say, I want to be unique to that geography. But in the future, by the way, as we think of other markets, like say China, there could be localization. I wouldn't rule that out. But what we do work with these schools is to say, can you give us global examples? So for example, if you do a digital marketing course with Columbia Business School, can you talk a little bit about examples in Latin America, in India, maybe even in South Africa? And so that is something that we work with. Now, the faculty, I must say, they have this toolkit and they can modify and pull in stuff. One of the things we also do is bring in industry experts, especially for the new age courses, fintech, blockchain, data science. There is so much that is happening that's actually being driven by industry. So we help modify. So this is the part that talk about taking an offline course online. You want to also make sure that reaches a broader audience because the geographical diversity is much more in these online courses.
Got it. And by virtue of that, is it fair to assume that most of the delivery happens in the English language?
That's a great question. So as we speak today, we just launched our first bunch of four courses that are now offered in Spanish out of our Mexico City office. But if you had asked me this question 3 months ago, yes, 100% of our courses were delivered in English. You know, 5 years from now, I would bet that maybe, you know, 30% of our students are learning in a local language, whether that's Spanish, whether that's Portuguese, whether that's Mandarin, potentially Arabic. And again, that's why I come back to say that our mission is about making high-quality education accessible. And sometimes language is also part of accessibility. And by the way, it takes various forms. In Mexico, they're used to watching Hollywood movies with subtitles. But in, I believe in Peru and Chile, they actually don't like the subtitles. They want dubbing. And so accessibility also with language means different things in different markets.
I have a question. From the way you started, which was largely a classroom-based program, bringing the highest quality of education that's available worldwide to a country such as India, was there Was there a point where you reached some sort of a glass ceiling that got you to think about online? I'm curious, where did that part emerge from?
Ankur, we always think of our business as box one, box two, and box three. This is not my framework. I'm just copying from Professor Vijay Govindarajan at Dartmouth. Box one is, you know, managing the prison. How do we get more efficient in the markets, the products, the tech that we have today? Box three is about the future. What are we doing so little of today, but 5 years from now, they may be 20-30% of our overall business. So for example, Spanish, Portuguese, Mandarin courses for us today is box three, but we are experimenting and investing in that today. And the difference between the two is that the metrics you use to measure box one is not the same as the metrics you use to measure box three. The people you use to run box one are not the people you use to run box three. And by the way, box two is what did we kind of trip up on? What mistakes did we make? But we can forget. So box one, manage the present. Box three, think, create the future. Box two, forget the past. Right. So for example, we tried to go into China 2 years back. We failed. But we will forget that and go back again, but we will learn from that, right? And so even 3-4 years back, we kept asking ourselves this question, what is box three for us? When we saw the MOOCs, so Coursera and edX launch in 2012, 2013, we said, ooh, universities are now more open to online than we thought they might be. And so we started imagining the future, which was box three, as saying, hey, maybe online is going to be much more significant. In fact, that led us in 2015 to raise a small angel round, in 2017 to raise our Series B, because we then realized we had to invest in product and tech. We couldn't rely on the universities to do that, right? And so we always think about this concept of box one, box two, box three. And my role and my management team's role is sitting today is to imagine the future of education 5 years from now and say, what's the box three ideas 5 years from now, but for whom we are making experiments and investments today?
Got it. Awesome. So tell me, Ashwin, about the story of going global.
We first moved to adjacent spaces. So we were based, like I said, initially all of our students were from India. And then we realized there's a large Indian diaspora in the Middle East, you know, 2.5 hours away. So we said, okay, why not offer some courses with the same universities in the Middle East? And then we realized that why not Singapore? And so these three kind of happened more as an extension of what we were doing. We were lucky to find good people. We made a few mistakes. So for example, in the Middle East, we hired an expat to run that business. And we realized that we really needed locals. And so when we changed the leadership, that region really was much more receptive. But I would say that things like Latin America and China are more deliberate, because there it's not so much about just extending what you do. You have to rethink what you're doing. So we started out with Middle East, Singapore. So between 2013 and 2016, we took about 3 years to see, can we make this work, right? Can a predominantly Indian management team pull off these geographies? And the answer was yes, because we also realized that we were pretty global in our mindset and our exposure. So that obviously helped. And then I think we kind of now have a toolkit of saying we can approach new markets. And so whether it's Mexico, whether it's Brazil, whether it'll eventually be China, I think we have a fair sense of how to go about this, learning from these experiences. But, you know, if we had tried to do all of this in a year, and some startups have, I think it would have been extremely challenging.
What has been, out of my curiosity, the hardest thing that you've encountered in the early days of going global?
It's always about people, right? It's always about people. And if you can find the right person, that's easy, but you never know who the right person is because there's so many variables. The hardest thing sometimes is not to take your dominant logic and apply that into that market, right? And so once you start realizing that every market is different, and so kind of embrace that, it becomes a lot easier. But it's just down to people. I mean, that is true of any business, honestly, so I don't think it's unique to just going global. The layers that are easier to solve that many times get spoken about are, you know, structuring, right? How should you think about, you know, local regulations or tax implications, etc. There are a bunch of experts you can assemble to do that for you. But what I think is supremely important to succeed from a business perspective is just the people. Who do you get on board to run that operation? Right? Can that person be an entrepreneur for you in that geography? Do they have high trust? can they imbibe the culture? If you can get those three, I think you're on a good path.
And if I heard you right, you said that you found locals to be a better fit than trying to shift people from India.
So, yeah, absolutely. Even hiring expats who are already there has not worked so well for us. Again, that's dominant logic, right? The expat speaks English, probably has a very high pedigree education. So you say, wow, I can trust this person. But locals really have worked well for us because I think they have a sense of, it's like an entrepreneur, right? You have a sense of an opportunity that a big company can't see. A local has a sense of the opportunity that somebody sitting, say, in India or in the US can't really smell. And so we will absolutely bet on locals versus sending people from other parts. And of course, it would help if the local has a global view, right? So if they were educated in the US or in India, if they are of Indian origin. So the person who runs our Latin American operations is of Indian origin. His wife is Mexican. He's worked in Mexico. He's worked in China. He's worked in Asia. So he has a world view. He's of Indian origin, fluent Spanish speaker. So if you can find those kind of profiles, it's obviously easier. But then finding them and getting them on board is always the challenge.
When you went global, Ashwin, you were running what I would call a predominantly offline business. And I'm super curious to know, how did you mentally and thereafter operationally also change how the company looked at itself in terms of its metrics, in terms of its costing structure, in terms of where the investments would go? What were the fundamental shifts that you had to make from the 0 to 10 and then the 10 to 100 journey?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, just as India was box one, box three is global, our offline business was box one and box three was online. And like I said, the kind of people you get to run box three are different. The metrics are different. Yeah. So it was about assembling a team that had different skill sets. By the way, I myself had worked in an OTA before. So online was not new to us. In fact, it's far more exciting in many ways, given the scalability. Mm. But in the context of what we do, we had to make sure that we had product design capabilities because we had to go create digital content with schools, right? So that's a whole new capability that we didn't have to do for our offline courses. We had to understand marketing in a very different way, completely driven of machine learning algorithms, right? And so we had to hire a bunch of people who did that. Honestly, Ankur, let me tell you this, there is so much talent in India to do a lot of this. And also when we hire in other markets, given that we are mission driven, it is, I think, easier for us to attract really high caliber people who want to make a difference, right? And so I think we've been somewhat fortunate, touch wood, that we have this local market that has a lot of talent, and we are mission driven. So that has helped, obviously. Now, the metrics that we use to measure online are also different than the classroom courses, right? So that was very clear when we did this online experiment. We were very clear that we would measure this differently, we'll have different people, and we would also think of this very differently, right? And so we used to have these conversations with our schools saying, you know what, we can run these online courses in 4 to 5 batches in a year. And they would say, oh, but we normally run a course once, maybe twice in a year. And so there was conversations to be had with partners as well. But it's really box three, reimagine your assumptions and you can hit upon a new business that can just take off tremendously. And that's what happened.
Did you at any point of time face any regulatory challenges or things that you weren't prepared for?
So, all the university partners we work with are, Ivy League or in that caliber. They are all very highly accredited. In many ways, we are a platform that makes them reach students and vice versa. We have looked carefully at regulation. Most of our courses today are certificate courses. And so we have stayed very clear of, any regulated brick and mortar kind of operation. We look at regulation very closely. But I think the benefit of working with these universities is that, they have all the permissions, licenses, and approvals that they need.
You mentioned this before, Ashwin, that a lot of the MOOCs today are largely unidimensional. They're designed to be one-way interaction. And I would imagine because of that, they continue to have problems of low completion rates. You guys pride upon the fact that it's a very healthy live interaction. And that, in your words, has led to high completion rates. Is there something that sets you guys apart from how people generally look at online education? Was there something that you consciously built in into the system from day one to ensure that high completion rates and high engagement was part of your DNA and thus part of your delivery?
Yeah, I think it was a conscious call. It comes from our DNA of working, through classroom programs in our early part of our evolution. And also most of our management team has attended, master's level programs at the universities we work with. And so this is in our DNA. But I think it raises a good question, right? In 2013, when we saw the evolution of the MOOCs, we had, as entrepreneurs, a decision to make. Do we want to be a copycat model of the MOOCs for India, for example? Or did we want to create a model that was different, that we believed in, that was tougher to build, but maybe had more barriers and moats to it that could scale globally? And I think many entrepreneurs, at least in my view, can take the easy part of saying, okay, this is something that works in some other market, let's just copy it here. We said, let's stay true to our mission. And our mission is high quality education. Education, again, not just content. And so it kind of then became obvious that what we had to do was to find the learning outcomes. How do we replicate the learning outcomes of the classroom, but in a digital classroom? And once you frame that as the decision or the, you know, what you're trying to solve towards, then the product market fit is built keeping that in mind.
All right, let's shift gears, Ashwin, and talk about how do you manage yourself as a founder of a fairly large company, which is quite global in nature. It's spread across multiple time zones. What's your key to managing your time across these hours and across these offices?
I think the first thing is to, where do you spend your time, right? And so for me, it has always been about finding the best team, assembling the best resources. That's where I spend a lot of my time. You don't want to be managing your global offices on their day-to-day. You want to set them up with a mission, give them the tools they need, and let them go. And then every now and then check in to see whether they need some help, whether there's some course correction. And so the time that I usually spend with the global teams is really on that, right? What help do they need? How can we get things out of the way so they can run faster? And in many cases with universities and partnerships. The second thing is to embrace technology. Right. All of our team is on, whether it's Microsoft Teams or WhatsApp, we all use that so we can schedule meetings very quickly, impromptu, as well as, you know, fortnightly reviews. We all use video conferencing, Zoom, or any other tool. And that is important as well. At the same time, to make sure that we meet every quarter in one location. So we met in Boston a couple of weeks ago. We'll meet in Mumbai in Jan. We'll meet in Mexico City in April. And so you want the face-to-face interaction, because I think many bonds are built when that happens, but you really want to embrace technology to also meet impromptu.
Do you see the future of education becoming decentralized in such a manner that the source of the education is just as fluid as the receiver of it?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, Eduditus presents one model in a very large $7 trillion education market. And so it's a model, and there will be many, many, many models, and there already are many, many, many models, right? You can, I think, both university-led models. By the way, why only global universities? We would love to work with Tech de Monterrey, with Tsinghua, with Peking University, with an IIT or an IIM. These are great universities, high quality in their own right. And so our next phase of our evolution would be to think about those and then go further from there and say, you know, are there local faculty who might be of very high credibility? But that is our model. I think there are many other models where marketplaces exist. If you look to, in the US and India, by the way, not just in higher ed, also in K-12, there are a bunch of interesting companies coming out of India that also I think will go global. Baiju's is an example. But that's the same case in China as well. So absolutely that there will be local instructors providing content to local students and entrepreneur can build scalable businesses off that.
With that, we come to the end of yet another episode of Building It Up with Bertelsmann. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Ashwin. I have gone away taking so much from this episode, and I hope you did as well. My conversations with Ashwin were fascinating. It's not easy to build an online education startup in this country, and least of all, making it so global in the way Eruditus has. So my best wishes to Ashwin for the future. And don't forget to subscribe to Building It Up with Bertelsmann, so stay tuned for the episodes that are to follow, and I hope you all have a wonderful week ahead. See you all. Bye.